The headlines: Israeli forces kill at least five Palestinians in pre-dawn raids on several locations in the occupied West Bank. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran will judge the U.S. by its acts, not words, and Iran's willingness to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. And Muslim pilgrims are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to mark Arbaeen, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Top story for this half hour: at least five Palestinians, including four members of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, have been killed in Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank overnight. Three of the five Palestinians were shot dead in the village of Beit Anan, northwest of Al-Quds. Another was killed in Burin, a village near the city of Jenin, while one more Palestinian succumbed to his wounds in hospital. Reports indicate clashes erupted in the occupied territories after regime forces carried out pre-dawn raids in at least four West Bank towns. Palestinians also staged a strike in the town of Bidu following the attacks. Meanwhile, Palestinian groups decried the latest Israeli atrocities.
Because of the martyrs, people in the West Bank and militants should point their weapons towards the Israeli occupation, the rapist Zionists, to defend our nation, our land, our holy sites, and to stress the equation of blood for blood and bullet for bullet in the West Bank and Jerusalem.
Hamas also added that Palestinians will continue their resistance to stop Israeli crimes. A group further called on the Palestinian Authority to end its security coordination with Tel Aviv and meetings with Israeli officials. Hamas underlined that the martyrdom of Palestinians is the result of the Palestinian Authority's constant coordination with Israel. Other Palestinian groups also said they would press ahead with their resistance against Israel. Iran says it will judge the United States by its acts, not words, in its willingness to return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
We have made it clear that we will judge Americans by their practical behavior, and their conflicting messages relayed to us through the media or diplomatic channels will not contribute to our decision making.
Amir Abdullahian made the comments as he was wrapping up a five-day trip to New York to attend the UN General Assembly. The top diplomat said Iran's conditions for returning to the talks in Vienna to revive the accord was a hot topic at his meetings. Amir Abdullahian said he discussed the issue in detail with his French, German, and British counterparts, as well as the EU foreign policy chief. Iran has already blasted the U.S. for failing to take a serious step to resume compliance with a pact it unilaterally left 3 years ago. Tehran says it wants the U.S. to remove all sanctions in a verifiable way before rejoining the accord. Author and commentator John Stepling says Iran has complied with the nuclear deal for years, so there's no point to discuss its commitment.
The question always comes back to the sanctions. There shouldn't be sanctions. They should be removed. There was never a reason for them. And as far as the JCPOA goes, it becomes a symbolic, concept more than anything else. Iran has already complied with everything asked of them for a number of years. They've bent over backwards to agreeably comply with all the often irrational requests of the Atomic Energy Commission, the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. You know, the JCPOA looms as kind of political theater. At this point, in 2021, such discussions are just ludicrous, and people should stop participating in them. I mean, Iran has done nothing. They're a sovereign nation. The U.S. has no business dictating anything to them or to anybody else. And yet, you know, the mainstream media, the giant corporate media and telecoms, are on the same page with the Pentagon, and they disseminate the same propaganda over and over and over for years and years and years.
Muslim pilgrims are marching toward Iraq's holy city of Karbala to mark Arbaeen. The pilgrims are converging on the city to observe the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arbaeen falls on September 28th. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims. It has allowed only 40,000 foreign visitors into the country, many of them Iranians. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with a tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. On this edition of the News Review program, Iraq's Supreme Judicial Council has reportedly issued arrest warrants for several participants of a conference in the northern city of Erbil on normalization of ties with Israel. Iraqi media said the council issued warrants for three people and pledged to target others as soon as they are identified. According to the reports, the council called the participation in the conference a crime. Earlier, the Kurdistan Regional Government said the conference was neither authorized nor approved by local officials. The KRG said the issues discussed in the conference do not reflect the views and policies of the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Prominent Iraqi figures, including the country's president and prime minister, have already slammed the conference as illegal. 300 people took part in the event organized by U.S. think tank on Friday. They called for normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mr. Masood Shajadeh from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, who's joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have journalist and political analyst Mr. Elijah Magnier, who's joining us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Shajadeh in London. First of all, give us your thoughts on this conference.
Well, this is the sort of the activities that the Zionists do to create the environment for normalization and expansion of their colonial power in the region and beyond. And the fact of the matter is there is, on one side, we need to oppose this because of the injustices that is taking place in occupied Palestine and the fact that this is a legal occupation, a brutal apartheid system, and is damaging not just the Palestinians, but anyone who stands against this brutal and illegal apartheid system. But I think another side is the fact that, you know, this level of apartheid, this level of racism, which we see day in, day out in Israel, showing its ugly head by people abusing anyone other than Jewish community, and in particular the Arabs, the way that they are actually abusing them in their demonstrations and so forth. It is really incredible. Anyone will want to extend that to their country and their region. And I think there has to be vigilance to try to stop it.
Mr. Magnier, what are your thoughts on this conference that took place? It has already received a lot of condemnation and has been slammed by officials in Iraq and the Iraqi Kurdistan region.
Thank you for having me. I think this is a very serious issue. First of all, the location of the conference that took place in the vicinity of the presidential palace, of the parliament, of the prime minister base, and it is impossible for 300 people to meet in one place in that particular sensitive, security-sensitive area without the knowledge of the Kurdistan regional authority. Secondly, this is not new, the presence of the Israelis and Zionists in the area of Kurdistan and their operation on the ground. So what we can't understand is we have the clear position from the president, who is a Kurdish, Barham Saleh, the speaker, who is Sunni, Halbousi, Muhammad al-Halbousi, and the prime minister, who is a Shia, Prime Minister al-Kazimi, who all three condemned this meeting. However, we don't see anything in the constitution that imposing on Kurdistan the same policy that the Iraqi government is adopting and preventing the access of Israel to the Kurdistan-Iraqi area that is part of Iraq. Therefore, what's happening in Kurdistan is extremely worrying and causes high concern. This attempt to normalize with Israel that we have seen in 2017 referendum when the Kurdish semi-autonomous region wanted to declare independent from an independent state from Iraq, and Israel was the only entity that was supporting the Kurds from splitting from Iraq. And we see this happening. This is very serious because there were tribes from Al-Anbar in western Iraq. There were other people representing the government from the education ministry. And the people in the conference were in connection with Israel, where the son of Shimon Peres was also presenting his take on it and greeting the people in the conference. So Israel will totally fail to normalize with Iraq because Iraq will never normalize with Israel. However, this is not going to stop the Israeli from attempting to do so, notwithstanding the fact that those who promoted the Abraham Agreement, and we're talking here about Benjamin Netanyahu, Jared Kushner, and President Donald Trump, are gone. So this attempt to continue normalizing with Israel will continue, but the West Asia, Middle Eastern country should be very aware and attentive of this attempt.
Mr. Shajar, a guest that we spoke to earlier said that the people of Iraq, they are opposed to any form of normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. How does that fall into the scope of this conference that took place there?
Well, the fact is that the people of whole region are against normalizing with Israel. As I said, one reason is the brutal sort of behavior, racist, apartheid behavior of Israel in the occupied territories, but also beyond that. It's not just in the region that people are in support of Palestinians and against it. The occupation, illegal occupation, even in Europe and even in United States, now day by day, month by month, year by year, people are awakening to the brutality and injustice and the apartheid system. Apartheid system is not just dangerous for the people who are under its control. It really needs to be removed in the same way that the apartheid system of South Africa was removed. And so therefore, really, Zionists are concentrating on a small group of people, the politicians in the West, and indeed some politicians elsewhere in the region. And the process of doing this type of thing and trying to sort of the first time everyone gets shocked, and if they don't put infrastructure to stop it happening again, then that becomes the first step of normalization. And normalization counts on the fact that bit by bit they will move forward to normalize this sort of apartheid system and its control and its influence in the region, economically, politically, etc. And I think we need to really give, to have the understanding what the system is, what it's trying to do, and how much resources puts in it, and not take this sort of activities of the Zionists lightly.
Mr. Magnier, we know that according to reports that a U.S. think tank had arranged this conference to take place, 300 people will not decide the fate of a country or whether there will be a normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. That's very obvious. So what were the motives and goals by holding such a conference?
This is a very good question. There are two motives to my mind. The first one is to try and do something to show to the world that it is possible to continue with the idea of normalization between the Arab countries and Israel. Secondly, is to see the reaction of the country's leaders to this conference, and had the reaction been soft or negligent or very shallow, then further step would have been taken to create more meetings in the same line of policy. And I think the reaction of the population of Iraq, the political leaders, was good. It was harsh enough to make sure that this is not going to happen again. And today, the Justice of Court is issuing an arrest against the people who attended the conference. So Israel will always try to show that there are alternatives, there are other opinions who may welcome Israel as and normalize with Israel, including in the heart of the axis of the resistance in Iraq, in this case, that represent a very important country in the area. And I think that the main reason why they've done that is because in Kurdistan, there is a reception, there is no hostility against Israel, and this is why they felt very safe to do it in Erbil.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Masoud Shajara from the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. And also thanks to journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. Now, so Germans are heading to the polls in a knife-edge national election to pick a successor to Chancellor Angela Merkel. After 16 years in power, more than 60 million people are eligible to cast their ballots to choose members of the lower house of the federal parliament, the Bundestag. The election is too tight to call. The center-left Social Democrats, or SPD, are posing a tough challenge to Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party. The retiring chancellor has urged voters to support Armin Laschet to shape the country's future. 60-year-old Laschet is running against Olaf Scholz of the SPD. Laschet has warned the SPD-led alliance would destabilize Europe with its plans. Scholz, 63, has said he's fighting for, quote, a major change in Germany. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 27th, 2021. One of the most representative examples of the active socio-political presence is that of the women of the Ahlul Bayt. as one trained in the school of Islam and attached to the household of infallibility, there are real examples of the idea that Muslim thinkers have put forward in their views on the role of women. Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, is a prominent example in the history who shows the active presence of a woman in one of the most important socio-political scenes of history. Shia identity is tied to Ashura culture, so that after the event of Ashura and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his companions, every socio-political movement formed in the history of the Shia has a relation, whether direct or indirect, to Karbala and benefit from its teaching. This close relationship between the socio-political currents of the Shia and the Ashura event shows that one of the most important aspects of this uprising is political. Now the question is whether this historical and identity-making political uprising was formed by women or men. Is the movement a masculine or a feminine or a human one? Certainly, the presence of the women of the Ahlul Bayt in the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala is known and an unalterable fact in the Islamic history. But was his presence a passive act in following their men, or was it an active complementary role playing alongside men? To answer this question, we should review the Karbala event from a feminine perspective. Although the main hero of Karbala is Imam Hussein alayhi salam, history cannot narrate the Karbala event without mentioning the name of Lady Zainab alayhi salam.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets to mark the 7th anniversary of the September 21 revolution against the Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a. Participants in the rally chanted slogans against foreign aggression, while carrying the country's tricolor flag and pictures of top resistance leaders. They also denounced the criminal complicity of Western powers and the Israeli regime in the Saudi-backed aggression and war-ravaged Yemen. The demonstrators vowed to uphold their revolutionary ideals and not surrender to the foreign powers. They said the popular revolution had thwarted the conspiracy to divide Yemen through resistance to foreign aggression and hegemony.
Yemeni people are working hard to liberate themselves from the tutelage and occupation. It is known to the world that the occupation does not last, and no matter how long it remains, it will eventually depart.
In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed, unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement on September 21 took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The massively popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh and directed by the U.S. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, the Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
I think at this present time, the Saudis are willing to keep this thing going. Even if they can't win, they'll keep it going so as to not be pointed at and said they lost. How long they can do this is, I don't know, but I think that's our present situation.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the U.S. was in charge of administering his country's internal affairs prior to the popular revolution against former Yemeni President Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi, better known as the September 21 Revolution. He highlighted that Washington used to conduct Yemen's affairs before the September 21 Revolution, and the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a had the upper hand over the presidential office. The Ansarullah leader went on to say that the U.S. used al-Qaeda terrorists to create division within Yemen and to advance its hegemonic agenda, stressing that Washington also sought to influence Yemen's educational system in favor of the Israeli regime.
The Saudis and the UAE are influenced by the U.S., as is the U.S. influenced by them. They are dependent often on U.S. weapons, of which they are major purchasers, and that makes us dependent on them. But they are not controlled by Washington.
He added that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are just pawns in the hands of the U.S. and are cows being milked by Washington to serve the Tel Aviv regime's interests. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched the war in Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Hadi's government back to power and crushing Ansarullah.
I don't think that the Saudis can win under present circumstances. And I think the support, whatever they got out of Trump, is probably less now, relatively speaking, under Biden. But there's this other factor, and the factor is that the Saudi government and the head of the Saudi government doesn't want to lose face. Now, you and I might be able to accept losing face under certain circumstances, but they don't believe that they ever want to lose face.
The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases. The Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees, however, have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders, leaving Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country. Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, has addressed the 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly via video conference. It was his first address to the main policy-making organ of the world body since taking office last month. During his speech, Raisi said the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have, quote, failed miserably, and that Washington's hegemonic system lacks credibility. Raisi said Washington is using sanctions as a new way of war against other nations, stressing that the U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic during the coronavirus pandemic are crimes against humanity. This year, two scenes made history. One was on January 6, when U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August, from the capital to Kabul. One clear message was sent to the world. U.S.'s hegemonic systems has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. He described sanctions as the U.S.'s new way of war with the world countries.
Raisi represents the anti-imperialist current of the Iranian population that is fed up with sanctions. For years, the U.S. has been imposing brutal sanctions that have devastated Iran's economy, killed families, working class families of Iran who are unable to access medicine, infrastructure, because of sanctions. And the goal all along with the U.S. was to impose sanctions, blame it on the policies of the Iranian government, make it seem like the U.S. needs to step in with humanitarian aid and overthrow the democratic government in Iran.
Ebrahim Raisi said sanctions against the Iranian nation started not with Iran's nuclear program, stressing that they predate the Islamic Revolution and go back to the year 1951, when oil nationalization went underway in Iran. The Iranian president also said, despite the fact that the Islamic Republic was keen from the outset to purchase and import COVID-19 vaccines from reliable international sources, it faced inhumane medical sanctions. He also described sanctions on medicine at the time of the COVID-19 pandemic as crimes against humanity.
But sanctions have been extremely crippling on all fronts, and the irony here is that the U.S. claims to be imposing sanctions for the purpose of humanitarianism, for human rights, when in reality, sanctions violate those very same human rights that they claim to be defending. It worsens people's conditions. It puts people further into poverty.
The Iranian president said that Tehran has been adhering to its nuclear commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, while Washington violated the 2015 landmark accord, stressing that the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. The Iranian president underlined that 15 reports released by the International Atomic Energy Agency have attested to the adherence of Iran to its commitments. However, the U.S. has not yet discharged its obligation, which is lifting sanctions. We want nothing more than what is rightfully ours. We demand the implementation of international rules. All parties must stay true to the nuclear deal and the UN resolution in practice.
The goal and intent of those imperialists in Washington, D.C., who wanted to impose sanctions, impose hegemony, their goal was to worsen the conditions in these countries to a point where people would be begging for U.S. interference, to blame that on the policies of those governments. This has actually had the opposite force, where the people of Iran know, the people of Venezuela know, the people of Cuba, Nicaragua, Peru, they know that it's not the policies of their governments that are creating crisis, but it's U.S. sanctions, U.S. hegemony, U.S. imperialism that is at the root of all of these problems.
Raisi said that Iran has no trust in U.S. promises and wants all anti-Tehran sanctions to be removed at once, noting that the Islamic Republic considers the nuclear talks useful only when their ultimate outcome is the lifting of all unilateral sanctions. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump left the JCPOA in 2018 and returned the sanctions that had been lifted against Tehran as part of the agreement. During his address at the UN General Assembly, Biden voiced his intention to rejoin the landmark nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in full, if Tehran does the same. He said the U.S. was working with China, France, Russia, Britain, and Germany to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to the JCPOA. But the U.S. has yet to take palpable measures to prove its commitment to the JCPOA since its 2018 withdrawal from the accord, in spite of international criticism.
Israeli officials have ramped up their anti-Iran rhetoric recently, accusing Tehran of seeking nuclear weapons and threatening the country with war. Israel's war of words against the Islamic Republic has intensified in recent months, especially after a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed tanker off the coast of Oman in July. Israel was quick to accuse Iran of carrying out the attack, pushing for a United Nations action against Tehran. This is while Iran has denied any involvement in the attack. On Monday, Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, said Iran has repeatedly stressed that its defensive power and progress in new technologies and domestic innovations are meant to ensure national security and respond to any external aggression. He said the Islamic Republic of Iran is determined to confront the enemy on all fronts, adding that its enduring power will mark many other glorious victories.
I believe that the Zionists are trying to provoke Iran into some sort of first strike policy. If Iran strikes the Zionist entity first, and of course they will have reason, in their opinion, to call upon the Americans and the Europeans in order to protect them. Of course, I don't think that Iran will fall for this trap. I mean, they have been provoked for decades. They understand what is going on. But what Iran is most likely going to do is continuously support the resistance of the Palestinian people, of the Syrian people, of the Lebanese people, etc., against the Zionist entity.
Taking a swipe at the Israeli regime, Brigadier General Ashtiani said Tel Aviv is resorting to accusations against Iran out of desperation. Also responding to the accusations, Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said while Tehran has been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, the world body has been in the dark about Israel's nuclear activities for well over five decades. The escalation of tensions between Iran and the regime in Tel Aviv comes amid a stalemate in talks aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, also known as the Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. government unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal in May 2018, despite Iran complying fully with its commitments under the deal. Many rounds of talks between Tehran and other remaining signatories to the accord were held recently in the Austrian capital, Vienna, without any definite breakthrough. Iran maintains that the Americans must make the first move by removing sanctions and carrying out all their obligations under the deal. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, under the pressure of the Israeli regime, has so far failed to honor its commitments of reversing measures taken by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, Iran isn't the only country Israel holds animosity toward. Apart from attacking Iran's nuclear scientists and sites, the regime has been carrying out raids against resistance groups in the region, particularly in Syria and Lebanon.
The core principle, of course, of the Zionist entity of Israel is that they are always trying to provoke their neighbors and wider nations as well, not even their immediate neighbors in the Islamic and Arab world in general, into further conflicts. Either amongst themselves or, of course, with the Israeli military. Now, in case of Iran, there is this growing regional powerhouse that has been developing a resistance factor in the area known as the Middle East since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution there. And this is something that has gradually started worrying Israel and the United States and much of Europe, of course.
What officials in Tel Aviv need to consider is how they can provoke war with multiple sides while they couldn't confront attacks launched by the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip in May.
On August 26th, a bombing outside Kabul International Airport killed scores of Afghans, as well as 13 American troops, as Afghan and foreign nationals rushed to leave the country. The incident marked the deadliest attack for U.S. troops in Afghanistan in over a decade, as Washington was wrapping up its evacuation operation. Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the bombing. Later, on August 29th, in one of the final acts of the U.S. military in Afghanistan before ending its 20-year war in the country, Washington launched a deadly drone strike in Kabul. In what the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, called a righteous strike, the Pentagon claimed it targeted a position of Daesh terrorists in retaliation for the bombing of the Kabul airport and killed at least one Daesh facilitator. However, on Friday, a U.S. Central Command investigation found that the drone strike killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, and not any Daesh terrorists.
It is further my assessment that the strike team were convinced at the time of the strike that the area was clear of civilians, and that they had taken prudent steps in regards to weaponizing the strike to minimize the potential for civilian casualties. Finally, it is my assessment that they did believe, as reported, that there was a secondary explosion. Our investigation now concludes that the strike was a tragic mistake.
General McKenzie said the U.S. intelligence had reasonable certainty that the suspected location was a Daesh position where terrorists were planning an attack on Kabul airport. The U.S. intelligence tracked an aid worker's vehicle, assuming it was linked to Daesh. They mistakenly thought the car was loaded with explosives, while it had only containers of water. In a statement, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin admitted that the strike led to tragic death of innocent civilians and called it a horrible mistake. The catastrophic consequences of the U.S. intelligence miscalculations have exposed the human cost of war that had been fought largely from the air for years. That will fuel the criticism of the Biden administration's Afghanistan policy and chaotic withdrawal of American troops from the country after 20 years of war. For the past two decades, Afghanistan has been a scene of a devastating conflict. The U.S. military conducted thousands of drone strikes, killing hundreds of civilians and children.
Yes, I think that last drone strike, unfortunately, is symbolic of 20 years of killing Afghans, of destruction, and of government lies. We were told so many times in the United States that the U.S. was winning when the Taliban was taking over more and more territory. And we were told that the drone strikes are very precise and they just take out the, quote, bad guys. And so when this last drone strike happened and it killed an entire family, after the U.S. military had said it took out somebody who was an extremist, who was about to blow people up at the airport, we have to start wondering about all of the strikes that have taken place.
The U.S. military has admitted it killed 10 innocent Afghan civilians and targeted the wrong vehicle in a drone strike in Kabul on August 29th. Now, Washington is facing a double whammy of mounting pressure from inside and outside the country over the handling of the withdrawal operation, as well as the failure of U.S. intelligence. The fact that this horrible mistake was made as the U.S. troops ended their 20-year occupation will make the shambolic U.S. withdrawal even worse. The Pentagon initially defended the attack on Kabul, stressing that it killed Daesh operatives despite media reports of civilian casualties. However, with Afghanistan being under global scrutiny, the U.S. had no choice but to admit to its failure. International humanitarian organizations have called for prosecuting those suspected of criminal responsibility in the act.
Sometimes I think the intelligence is just bad, like the fact that they couldn't predict that the Taliban was ready to take over Kabul. Sometimes I think the military just doesn't care if it kills a lot of civilians and pretends that it was militants who were killed. They figure who's going to go and do the reporting, because a lot of times it's in remote areas that is very difficult for reporters to get to. And sometimes I think they use the intelligence, or they manipulate the intelligence for their own ends. For example, in the case of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there was certainly a manipulation of the intelligence to tell the American public and the world that there were weapons of mass destruction when there weren't.
That's why the U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Syria, Iraq, and Somalia, out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility, while destroying the lives of civilians.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is the teacher. We will tell you the story of the martyrs of the sacred defense of Iran.
این عظمت رو کی به ملت ایران داد؟ در صف اول
Who has given this greatness to the Iranian nation? On the first row were our dear martyrs of the state.
و اگر امروز من یا تو از این صحنه عقب بنشینیم به خواست اراده خودمون
I told the commander, if we retreat from our position in front of enemy now, we won't have any answer for the martyrs.
And if today we are the guardian of our revolution, and if today we are the guardian of the blood of the martyrs, and if the will of God
Today's story, The Life and Character of Shahid Mahdi Zainuddin. Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Shahid Zainuddin was one of those who rendered services to the downtrodden ones living in different cities. When Imam Khomeini ordered that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps be formed, Shahid Zainuddin was one of the first persons who volunteered to join the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Due to the commitment, diligence, and intelligence that he demonstrated, he became the official of the intelligence unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Qom. This was when he was just 20 years old. And now, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, talks about the martyrs of the Iranian sacred defense, including Shahid Mahdi Zainuddin.
ملت ایران از همه ملت‌های دیگر قوی‌تر است.
The Iranian nation is stronger and greater than any other nation in the world. Who has given this greatness to the Iranian nation? On the first row were our dear martyrs of the sacred defense era, martyrs like Zainuddin, Sadiqi, and Haydarian. These were the people who manifested their belief not only in their tongue, but also in their practice.
این باور را نه در زبان، در عمل این باور را نشان دادن.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. When the imposed war of Saddam against Iran started, Shahid Zainuddin became one of the commanders in the intelligence unit. This was because he displayed his courage in the battlefield many times. Shahid Zainuddin had laid a condition for getting married. He had said that the person I marry must be someone who is able to cope with our difficulties. This is because we are men of war. Ultimately, Shahid Zainuddin was able to find a patient person to get married to, and the outcome of this marriage was a daughter named Layla. And now let's listen to the voice of Shahid Mehdi Zainuddin and its English translation.
فرمانده گردان حضرت رسول در اون لحظاتی که موج تانک‌های دشمن رو می‌آمد به طرف گردانش و می‌گفت به من
Once I was in the battlefield with a commander of Hazrat Rasul battalion. He was shocked by the attacks of the Iraqi tanks and asked me what to do. I resemble that scene of the attacking of the Iraqi tanks for him to the scene at Karbala. These tanks must not enter our land, I said. If so, they must pass over our dead bodies. We cannot let the enemy pass over our land because we are responsible for our people's lives and we must save the blood of our martyrs. Now at that time, I told the commander, If we retreat from our position in front of enemy now, we won't have any answer for the martyrs in the other world, because we wasted their blood by our irresponsibility.
September 1980, the Ba'ath Iraqi forces led by Saddam attacked Iran. Iranians from all ages stood against this oppression. Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, invited all Iranians for a holy defense. All the people accepted this call. The mothers sent their young sons to the battlefields. The Iranian commanders, including Shahid Zainuddin, were full of divine light.
Allahumma inni as'aluka rahmatan
The brave men trusted in Allah and defeated the enemy. For them, martyrdom was not the end, but a start, a new start, a new life.
شهادت آغاز است. تبدیل است در جهان از آن که عقل زمینی به ساحت قدس آن راه یابد. تولد ستاری.
And they still continue the path of their father.
با امت حزب اللهیم دل داده روح اللهیم با امت حزب
اللهیم. Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. Shahid Zainuddin was extremely down to earth, such that on many occasions, people didn't think he was a commander. He would wear simple clothes, and his humility was one of the distinctive characteristics of his. The last days of Shahid Zainuddin's life was like none other, and the illumination of his face spoke of a great event. Martyrdom is the art of men of God, as the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei has said. Shahid Mahdi Zainuddin was one of the men of God who had such a virtue. Shahid Mahdi Zainuddin had become the commander of Division 17 of Ali ibn Abi Talib while he was 23 years old. Ultimately, after long years of defending Islam and his country at the front lines, he was martyred in 1984 along with his younger brother. Shahid Zainuddin is buried in the graveyard of martyrs near the shrine of Imamzadeh Ali ibn Ja'far. May Allah bless this great martyr and elevate his ranks. And now, Sister Zainab reads to us an excerpt of the last will of today's Shaheed.
The condition for the protection of Islam is belief in Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. No one can protect Islam if he doesn't have faith and certainty in Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. If today we are fighting in the scenes of the struggle, and if today we are the guardian of our revolution, and if today we are the guardian of the blood of the martyrs, and if the will of God is said to spread Islam in the world, through the hands of you fighters and the Iranian nation, to provide the grounds of the reappearance of the Imam of our time, it is through the love, affection, and fondness of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him.